Chapter 19. As soon as the door to the box was opened, they saw Professor Lewis, a man having the worst day of his life. "Oh, thank God above," he said, rushing toward them. "I never thought I'd get out of here."
"You're not," Rolf said, "but at least you'll have some company now."
Quentin, Jake, Nick, and Kate were all pushed forward into the center of the room. It wasn't hard to see how the room got its name. It was a perfect cube, with the same high windows they'd seen in Eggar's Hall, 6 feet off the ground to keep out the blowing sand. But these particular windows all featured 3 metal bars, like a jail cell from the Old West.
"We'll be back as soon as Herr Eggar is ready," Rolf said. "In the meantime, you can all decide who goes first."
"Just hold on," Nick said, coming back to stand next to Rolf. "Can we talk about this for a minute?"
"There's nothing to talk about, Mr. Fox."
Nick draped his arm around Rolf's shoulder and leaned toward his ear.
"See, here's the thing, Rolf. We haven't even signed our contracts yet, and this dressing room is just not going to cut it.
We're going to need a full buffet table, with a wet bar."
Rolf smiled at him.
"You no longer have to worry about who goes first. It's going to be you, my friend."
"Oh, and a big bowl of M&Ms, Nick said, "with all of the brown ones taken out." Franz stepped forward, picked up Nick, and threw him back into the middle of the room. The door slammed shut behind them.
"If I find any brown ones in there," Nick called after them, "I'm going to be pissed."
Nick turned around and showed everyone the black iridium satellite phone he'd just picked from Rolf's pocket, then tossed it to his father.
"You better hurry up and call Ducky," he said, "before Rolf notices this is missing."
When Quentin was done with the call, he handed the phone back to Nick.
"He tried to follow us in Morocco," Quentin said, "but he lost us when we crossed the border."
"How soon can he get here?" Nick asked.
"He's tracing our signal. He'll be here as soon as he can."
"I need something a little better than that," Nick said. "Did you hear what Rolf said? I'm first."
Jake glanced over and noticed that Professor Lewis had gone over to sit in the corner by himself. He went over to him and kneeled down next to him.
"Professor Lewis, are you okay?"
"I tried to fight them off," Lewis said. "I really did. But there were 3 of them, including the big one. The worst part was sitting next to Eggar on the plane. He's quite brilliant, you know, but also quite barking mad."
"That's one way to put it," Jake said.
Nick went over to the door and inspected the lock.
"I could probably open this," Nick said. "But then what?"
"We could steal one of the vehicles," Kate said.
"Those are on the opposite end of the compound," Nick said.
"But you're right. That might be our only shot if Ducky doesn't get here in time."
A full hour passed. Nick and Kate were sitting together against a wall. Quentin and Professor Lewis were sitting against the opposite wall. Jake was pacing back and forth like a caged animal.
"He's making us wait," Kate said. "It's a power trip."
"Like an interrogation," Nick said. "Remember how long you made me wait before you finally came in to question me?"
"That seems like a lifetime ago right now,"
Kate said.
"But yes, I remember."
Quentin got to his feet and went to stand next to Jake, who was staring at one of the high windows.
"I don't think we're getting out that way," he said.
A low, half-whispered voice from outside answered.
"You always were a pessimist, Quentin."
"Ducky, how did you get here so fast?"
"You wouldn't believe me if I told you. You'll have to see for yourself."
They all watched as a hand appeared at the window. It grabbed one of the bars and rocked it back and forth. The bar moved slightly in the old masonry. The hand disappeared for a moment and a thick rope was fed through one side of the window, looped across all 3 bars, then back out the other side. There was a low, guttural sound as the rope was suddenly pulled taut.
Something not human.
"Easy,"
Duckworth said in a hushed voice. The rope went slack again,
then taut. Then it started to pull, hard on the bars. One bar snapped free, then the second, then the third. The window was open. At the same time, they heard footsteps outside the door. "You first," Nick said, putting his hands down to make a step for Kate. She grabbed the edge, lifted herself up, and climbed through. Nick did the same for the professor, leaving Jake and Quentin to debate who would go next. "We could all just stay here and get killed," Nick said. "Let's go. Dad, you first." Quentin took the step from Jake's hand, climbed through the window. Jake followed. The noises outside the door were getting louder. Someone was about to enter the room. Nick looked up at the window, jumped, caught the edge of the window, and pulled himself through, just as the door opened behind him. A submachine gun strafed the wall. Nick jumped to the ground. When he stood up, he saw six camels. On top of each was a local Sahrawi, dressed in a brightly colored, long flowing jalaba. Duckworth, Quentin, Jake, Kate, and Professor Lewis were already on board five of them, holding on tight behind the drivers. That left one for Nick. "Jump on," Quentin said. "Let's go." Nick ran and jumped again, grabbing the Sahrawi's hand to help himself up. And then they were off. The camels headed south, away from the compound, moving surprisingly fast. A minute later, Kate heard the sound of gas-powered vehicles. As she looked back, she saw the first of the Desert Patrol Vehicles, or DPVs. They were essentially souped-up dune buggies that often carried heavy armament. As the DPVs got closer, Kate was relieved not to see any 50-caliber guns riding on top. But the man in the passenger seat of the lead vehicle leaned out and tried to spray them with his submachine gun. The DPV was bouncing up and down on the rough terrain, enough to keep his fire wildly erratic. But one smooth stretch of sand and they'd all be sitting ducks. Or rather, sitting camels. "They put their bombs in the sand," the man driving Kate's camel said with remarkable calm. "What do you call them? Landmines?" "Yes. The landmines. They put them in our ground. They hide them in the night. But we watch them." On cue, the man turned his camel hard to the right, at the same moment that every other driver made the same maneuver. The animal responded with more dexterity than anything weighing over 1,000 pounds should have, and Kate had to grab the driver's waist to avoid falling off. As she looked back, the DPV kept on a straight line for another few yards, until, with an ear-splitting bang, the sand erupted beneath the wheels, sending the vehicle 20 feet in the air. The camels picked up speed, spooked by the loud noise behind them. Kate saw Duckworth grimacing in pain as he held on tight to his driver. This wasn't great therapy for a man just out of the hospital. "Hold on," Kate's driver said, cutting hard to the left, again at the exact instant that every other camel made the same move. Another DPV roared past on their right. This time Kate could see the driver's face as he realized what was about to happen. His last moment on Earth before the landmine exploded. When Kate looked back one more time, she saw no other vehicles behind them. Her relief was cut short when one more DPV appeared on the horizon. As it quickly closed the gap, she saw that it was being driven by Franz, who made the vehicle look like a toy. His body cramped into the cab and his head sticking out above the windshield. The driving sand whipped against his face, so hard it was probably already drawing blood. But he kept coming at top speed. As Franz neared the camels, his strategy became clear to Kate. He hadn't even bothered to bring a gun with him. He was going to knock them all down like bowling pins. Kate looked around desperately, trying to find some way to stop him. Then she spotted the knife in the belt of the driver. "I'll pay for this," Kate said, as she pulled it from his belt. It was sharp and heavy, with a 6-inch blade. She weighed it carefully in her hand, turning her body as much as she could without falling off. Kate waited for Franz to get closer. Then she threw the knife. It lodged into Franz's right arm. Franz looked at it like it was a mild inconvenience, pulled it out with his left and threw it into the sand. He picked up speed and approached the last two camels in the pack.
Wahid, the driver of one of the two lead camels, yelled, Athnan, Thalat, Anquissam! The camel drivers split off at exactly the same time, three camels going left, three going right. It created a moment of indecision for Franz. One moment too many. He tried to pull right, quickly changed his mind, then went left, but it was too late. The explosion of the landmine threw him from the vehicle, catapulting him Mad Max style as he turned end over end in the open space between the camels. For a split second, he caught Kate's eye. A moment of recognition. Maybe even a goodbye. And then his body hit the sand, where he slid a good 40 yards. As soon as he stopped sliding, he tried to raise his head, but then his airborne vehicle landed on top of him and burst into flames. The camels finally slowed down. Kate's driver patted his on the neck. Batal, he said, one of the few Arabic words that Kate knew. It meant hero. Kate rubbed the camel on his rump, said the same word. Batal. After another 30 minutes in the desert, they reached the small oasis town of Bir Leilu. There were many more of the same simple, single-story buildings like Agar had claimed for his citadella. But instead of sociopaths pacing around in desert camo, here were Sahrawi of both genders, all dressed in their jalabas of every color, and children running around chasing a soccer ball. Those bastards thought they were being clever, Duckworth said to the group, picking a spot in the no-man's land between Morocco's territory and the Sahrawis. They didn't realize. It works both ways. I could have rolled a tank into that place, and nobody would have noticed, or cared. Instead, you chose camels, Nick said. When in Rome. But seriously, these good folks did not care for those men coming in here, taking one of their old outposts and planting landmines. They were quite eager to help me. Which reminds me, by the way, you're all going to help pay for a new wing on the school. Glad to do it, Nick said. But how do we get out of here? There's an airstrip 1/2 kilometer away, Duckworth said, with the jet waiting for us. Will that do? They all thanked the Sahrawi one more time and headed over to the airstrip, a simple ribbon of pavement laid out on the flat desert floor. Food and cold beverages were waiting for them. Kate sat next to Nick as the jet took off and looked out at the vast open expanse below. We got the professor back, she said, but that was only item one on my list. Now we return to the hunt, Nick said, nodding to their fathers. They were on the other side of the plane, strapped in on either side of the table. Tell me about this logbook, Lewis said. Every detail you can remember, especially that last page. I can do better than that, Duckworth said, taking out a piece of paper. I didn't understand half of it, but I did write it all down. Brilliant! The professor took the paper and studied it carefully. I understand the part about the betrayal, Duckworth said, but then I got lost right around here. What's Tief Brunnen vom Eisenmann? That's the part that got Edgar excited, Quentin said. He acted like his grandfather had sent down a message from heaven. The professor wasn't listening to them anymore. He was staring at the words on the page, mouthing them to himself over and over, just as Edgar had done. Tief Brunnen vom Eisenmann. Tief Brunnen vom Eisenmann. Brunnen is well, he finally said. Tief is deep. And of course the Germans will always make a compound noun by joining the words together. Tiefbrunnen, deep well. But vom Eisenmann? Of the Iron Man? They all thought about it for a moment, until Professor Lewis slapped his own head. The Iron Man, he said. That was Goering's nickname. The same man he worked for, Quentin said. The man who betrayed him. That's right, Lewis said. Which tells me exactly where we have to go next.